At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hello, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. Tonight, we're going to be discussing the very viral interview between Joe Rogan and Wesley Huff. And this has definitely been a major moment in evangelicalism. And I think it's a very good moment for Protestantism as a whole, because we kind of needed this after people like Neil Shenvey were affirming heresy about Muslims and Christians worshiping the same God, and David Reese was spouting off Trinitarian error. So we needed something like this, and Wesley Huff delivered, and you love to see that. This was a positive development, and it also coincides with something that we talked about last week on the live stream, and that was a national revival being underway. And this national revival, as we said last week, is being driven by bro culture, which is well embodied by Joe Rogan in many ways. So to see this then happen on Joe Rogan, I do think is a confluence of events that kind of supports the narrative that, hey, there is something going on in the United States. And I listened to the interview yesterday for 3 hours, although I did it on 1.5 speed because it's 3 hours, got to get through that. And I'm not a Joe Rogan listener, but it was pretty solid. And then I also went to a men's Bible study last night. So it's like very much the bro renaissance or awakening in this country just resonates with me a lot right now. And I see this as another extension of that, big, touchdown throw for evangelizing the culture. So those are some of my initial reactions. We'll get into more questions. What about your initial reactions, Anthony?
Yeah, I was overall very impressed by the interview. It didn't fail to deliver as far as a lot of the online reaction was very positive towards the interview. And sometimes when you get someone that mentions God or Jesus or something like that, you get a lot of evangelicals that desire to just glom onto that in hopes of just having some ounce of cultural credibility or sway into the culture, just trying to say, hey, look, we have something in the culture, or as some kind of claim. And contrary to what one might think, he did deliver fully on the promise of an actual good Christian presentation on the Joe Rogan Show, which would be the largest online platform and probably the most impactful as well. Because, I mean, in the space of major tier podcasters, I mean, you have Joe Rogan, Patrick Beck David, Lex Friedman, and Rogan's probably the most organic of all three.
Please
of them.
Tell me. Other two aren't really on that list of most.
No, but as far as people that can get major names.
Yeah, I mean,
Rogan came out of nowhere, but Rogan.
Because I saw Lex Friedman, who I think came out of Rogan. I want to say that's why he's famous. And his interviewing skills and the questions that he asked Zelensky, who he recently had on, I'm like, you got to be kidding me here.
Rogan's a force. He actually arose by merit, by putting in the grind. He's not a product of industry. He did it his own way. And
I really respect his career being very early on an early adopter of UFC. And people complain about why is he on UFC, because he was there from the beginning supporting the sport when they were doing it on Indian reservations or something like that. Then he also did Fear Factor. Not a fan of his stand-up comedy, though. I don't think his stand-up's very good. But other than that, he seems like a very likable guy. I don't dislike Joe Rogan. And I think his podcast is much better for the culture than it is harmful. And Although that kind of understates my compliments. So let's talk about Wesley Huff for a minute. A lot of people did not know who he was, and I can't blame them. And in the world of apologetics, there's just not a there aren't as many good names as there should be. Like, a lot of these people that are big names are cringe. Ravi Zacharias was cringe.
Sean McDowell.
Sean McDowell
promotes every form of liberalism you can think of in the church.
Yeah, Sean McDowell is hardcore woke.
I mean,
I believe that's I was asked that earlier today. Is Sean McDowell woke? I'm like, the dude's boss is Ed Stetzer at Biola University. Biola University is really woke.
I mean, literally late last year, he promoted the David raped Bathsheba narrative.
Well, yeah, and he promotes Psi B theology, so he's compromised on a lot of issues.
So that's him. Then you get, like, I mean, you know, I did the article, like, in 2023.
William Lane Craig is supported in Christian circles, and that dude is not even remotely Orthodox.
Well, I did, like, Frank Turek, who everyone wants to defend and affirm the existence of God, but apparently God wasn't clear on what is and is not a pastor. You got Jeremiah Johnson at Prestonwood, who thinks IVF is an acceptable way to procreate children.
Yeah, people who do apologetics are very good at the apologetics, but oftentimes they lack in other areas. Wesley Huff, not saying that about him, but a lot of these apologetics people, people see them as champions of the faith and therefore ignore all these other bad things about them that might be true. And, you know, like William Lane Craig is an absolute heretic. And people ignore that because he argues for the existence of God against atheists. And he's not terrible at that. But people assume that his works equals salvation. He does these works, so therefore he must be saved. And that's not exactly how it works.
Very Catholic.
So that's the point that I'm trying to make. So Wesley Huff, there are a couple yellowish flags. One of them is that he's written for the Gospel Coalition Canada a handful of times. So he's Canadian, yes.
I mean, and
he's
Canadian. Canadian was the yellow flag. Let's just be honest with ourselves. I mean, yeah, he's not. I mean, obviously, he was like a no name, or maybe not no name, but like under 100,000 subs. I think he had under 50,000 subs when all of this began, because he goes on and debates Billy Carson in a debate, and then
he crushes him.
Absolutely crushes him. There's a lot of YouTube drama in the ensuing aftermath, because Billy Carson was upset that, you know, he didn't want the video out there of him getting humiliated. So the Streisand effect kicked in, you know, kind of like with Stone Choir and James White and Doug Wilson, just to make a comparison. But yeah, and then, you know, 2 weeks ago, he has the picture surfacing of him with Rogan doing the sit down interview. And that's when I heard of Huff. But the guy's gained like 200,000 subscribers since October. That's insane.
Yeah, he's on a meteoric rise, and I don't begrudge that at all. I hope this is for good. I hope he does not get conceited in this, because we're going to talk about that danger in a minute. You referenced that danger in the beginning in your opening remarks. But along the lines, he's Canadian. He's written a handful of times for TGC Canada. But I will say this. The people at Protestia, I believe Dustin specifically, was very enthusiastic about the prospect of Wesley Huff on Joe Rogan. So there are some people in the discernment world that were very excited about this development. And then he's also a fan of James White. And I know we've been very critical of James White for the last 3 months here, but someone who's a fan of James White, definitely could signal that they're a lot more based than someone in apologetics who's not. You know, for instance, the other Paul, very based. He's also a huge James White fan, and certainly started out as one. So just to be clear, but again, people in the apologetics world, most of them aren't very based. Just saying. It's a generality because it's true. But Wesley Huff goes on Joe Rogan and he crushes it. And the big thing that he crushes it on is defending the validity of scripture. And I thought that was huge and very necessary in our culture to defend the Bible as a source of truth. So that's part of the whole Protestant win, because he defended the, you know, institute, you know, the Bible, and, you know, wasn't relying on the authority of the church or whatever. So it was a very Protestant apologetic in that he led with the Bible, was defending the Bible's validity as a source of truth. And he went into a lot of the nitty gritty on the language, and getting into how things became canon, how things did not become canon, and how we can know that these apocryphal books should not the Old Testament Apocrypha, but the New Testament apocryphal books, how we know those are illegitimate forgeries. So that was excellent. I thought that this was an excellent presentation in defense of the Bible, and I think that's going to get people tuning in.
And keep in mind, he does that towards, I guess, the middle or whenever, but he already establishes his expertise and credentials in non-biblical languages. So they are ancient Near East, with talking about Akkadian and Sumerian. So he's talking about those languages before he even bothers talking about Hebrew and the manuscript of John, which is the P52, which is an index card size piece of parchment that is the oldest manuscript evidence we have of the New Testament. But, and again, that's not a novel argument, but for a lot of the audience, I imagine it was, and they probably did not know that there was a manuscript, which I think he kind of undersells, because I think it's dated as early as 95 AD, but so possibly even first century.
No, he does grant that it could have come from first century.
Oh, well,
I think so.
But yeah, a lot. He brings, I mean, that's the strongest case, and he does bring the strongest material to the table.
Yeah, the only, if I want to be critical, and the biggest yellow flag was when he says that he's a big believer in intelligent design. So his views on creation, I wonder about, but I don't think he's a Tim Keller theistic evolutionist.
Yeah, I mean, I do note that in my article that, you know, he does leave that door open that other alternative views could be acceptable, which he's certainly, I think he does mention theistic evolution and presumably old earth creation.
I just don't get the point of intelligent design. Like, it makes no sense.
Yeah, but I mean, he didn't necessarily espouse any particular view for himself, but he does kind of open that door and kind of leave it a little wide open, which again, a non-believer is probably not going to catch that or even understand that he did that, but it and perhaps it's just a means by which just to get the foot in the door, not really assert a strong position, because you're trying to sell the gospel first and foremost, rather than hash out this weed on, you know, 6-day creation versus 6-day age creation. So I kind of get that part, but he does leave the door open. He does talk about the validity of multiple views. I think he even at one point talks about, you know, he does use the Bible's not a science book.
Yeah.
So, which again, that's generally a buzz phrase for inserting it could have been, you know, evolution. So that, I do think that was a little bit of a caution flag.
But other than that, he did really well. And I want to be very, I want to commend that. I do want to say, aside from the Billy Carson thing, physiognomy matters, right? And if this guy, Wesley Hoff, is a fit, good-looking guy, I have to imagine if he were ugly or effeminate looking, he would not have made it onto the Joe Rogan Experience. Am I wrong about that?
I mean, keep in mind the early.
Look like Preston Sprinkle. Would he have made it onto the Joe Rogan Experience?
I mean, he would probably get eaten alive. Might last longer than Kamala Harris, though.
So, but Paul says that physical strength is of some value. I just want to be clear.
And keep in mind the early portions of the interview, when they're not talking about the debate with Billy Carson, they're talking about his early life and how he was, I guess he had
track. He was in track, right?
Yes. But he had the flu and basically was paralyzed for a month. And then, so he had no ability to walk. And then he walks over to his wheelchair, which is kind of funny if you think about it. And that kind of gave him the drive to be a track star. When that's like the first like piece of personal information you really learn about him, that really makes him very sympathetic and receptive to his audience. And the audience is very receptive to him.
Yeah. And they also talked about like him not atrophying and stuff like that. And that was regarded as a miracle. So it was a good interview. It was very long, over 3 hours. And there's a couple clips that we can play and I think are going to be worth playing. And the first one, we can talk about the resurrection clip. So I'm going to pull that up. But first, Evangelical Dark Web, Christian news gathering and commentary ministry. You can support our work over at evangelicaldarkweb.org/join. That is linked in the description below.
Changes, untold.
So
changes the course of human history.
You're able to see screen. Okay. Yes. Just buying time here.
I think changes of the direction that the ideology that these people subscribe to and the moral and ethical structure that they live their life by. It changes untold billions of human beings from that point on.
Yeah.
Pretty fascinating. Yeah. That in itself, even if this is just a revelation without a divine interaction, that's a fucking miracle.
Yeah.
It's a miracle that it was created at all. Like the whole idea that Christianity, when you're saying that the book of Isaiah?
Yeah.
That the same book is exactly the same as, like, that's a miracle.
Yeah.
That's pretty fucking crazy.
Yeah, that is crazy.
If you just imagine the sheer number of illiterate people, the sheer number of days that have to go by where people are telling the story exactly the same, and that it's entrusted in the hands of these very few people that are so dedicated to it that they get the exact words right 1,000 years later, pretty bananas.
Well, I mean, that is kind of the crazy thing about Christianity, where you have this Jewish itinerant guy who's walking around for a century Roman-occupied Judea. He's making some pretty audacious claims to be God himself, and then he predicts his own death and resurrection, and then his disciples, they think it's over. Like, they're like, he's dead, we're done.
Yeah.
And then they go from 11, you know, scared men, because Judas commits suicide, as scared men in an upper room, to completely overhauling the Roman world in only a couple hundred years because of this claim that they say they saw Jesus resurrected. Like, there's something different that goes on there, that they're like, this is a miracle, right? Dead people don't usually rise from the dead.
So what is your...
So I wanted to pause there because Wesley Huff was accused of not giving Joe Rogan the gospel. And I kind of wanted to weigh in on that when he just brought up the resurrection, which is one of the central claims of Christianity, is the resurrection and that Jesus is God. We haven't gotten to that part of the discussion yet, but here he is defending the resurrection and the validity of the resurrection, and he attributes the resurrection being real to why Christianity is the way that it is. Why did it rise and eventually take over the Roman Empire? Why did it do that?
I mean, keep in mind, Rogan's making that argument for him, that Christianity started off small, and then the fact that it's still around despite despite the fact that it's been 2,000 years, Christianity is still around. It's impacted billions of people. He's making that argument for Huff. Like, Huff doesn't have to make that argument. Rogan's doing it for him.
So the fact that people attacked him for not sharing the gospel, I just thought was an inappropriate attack on Wesley Huff. Because, I mean, first of all, Joe Rogan knows the gospel. I don't know if we have a clip of that, but Joe Rogan articulates the gospel that Jesus died for our sins and stuff like that. He articulates that. He understands the gospel. It's not about presenting him the gospel. It's about getting It's about Joe Rogan believing in the gospel, or by extension, his audience believing in the gospel, receiving the gospel. That is, it doesn't have to be an altar call. And I posted that on the Twitter sphere. You know, Wesley Huff did not do an altar call. Instead, he spent 3 hours defending the validity of scripture. I'm sorry, people are upset by this.
Yeah, I mean, you just need like a cheesy scene with some music playing in the background. And, you know, you have to be like as on the nose as possible.
And that's a reference to Elon Musk and his appearance on the Babylon Bee podcast, where they made a joke of that, but the podcast was otherwise not substantive on the whole gospel at all.
I mean, he's not telling Joe Rogan he's 70% there.
Exactly.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
And again, one thing I made a mention of Joe Rogan is that he's kind of a seeker, but his problem isn't whether he believes in miracles or doesn't believe in miracles. It's whether it's almost, you know, it's as Paul says, you know, the Jews seek signs and the Greeks seek wisdom. It's he needs that wisdom component because, you know, the Romans and Greeks probably had no problem believing in miracles. They probably had like witches everywhere that said that they could perform miracles. They probably would have thought, you know, Jesus was just this Jewish magician in some backwater. Oh, he rose from the dead. Okay. Yeah, who cares? Or the Romans would think, oh, is he trying to overthrow, you know, Caesar? No. Okay. We don't really care about him. He's just a magician in the backwaters. Oh, he grew, you know, he sojourned in Egypt. You know, Egypt's known for magic. So, you know, the Romans wouldn't have necessarily cared about the claims. What mattered to them was the wisdom. Like Paul needs to articulate that, you know, this event is significant because they are sinners, because they are imperfect, that they were created flawed. So that's where Rogan needs. He seems to have no problem believing in supernatural.
Can I just comment on that for a second? The logo for the Joe Rogan Experience has Joe Rogan's face with a third eye.
Yeah.
Like the guy is into some things, but, and I'm going to pull up this chat here because it's actually quite something that Rogan would have someone on vaguely an actual believer. Yes. And this is the largest pot. This is the most significant podcast in the world. Like, I don't know if he's the largest YouTube channel or not because Mr. Beast exists. And so does, man, what's that children's cringe? Coco Melon. That probably makes children dumb or something. So those are like your largest channels, but Joe Rogan, definitely one of the largest podcasts and most impactful as well. I mean, there's a reason why Donald Trump wanted to be on there. And there's a reason why why Kamala didn't want to be on there. So moving on, let's get back into this clip.
Your personal belief when it comes to the resurrection, what do you think? Do you have a belief, or do you just try to interpret the text and try to see what is the message?
Well, I think so. As a historian, I do think it is a historical question. You have a guy who objectively lived, he objectively died, and then individuals close to his inner circle claim that they see him not dead.
Right.
Again,
this is a highly unusual activity.
Highly unusual.
Right. So, but it's hard when you're dealing with illiterate populations, you're dealing with thousands of years of time, you're dealing with an oral tradition, and then you have us sitting here talking about it in 2024, trying to figure it at the end of 2024, trying to figure this out, literally the end, last couple of days. It's very difficult for anybody who thinks of themselves as an intelligent person who's secular to even entertain the possibility that someone died and come back to life.
And I get that. But we've already talked about the fact that we don't think that the only thing that exists is matter and motion. We as in you and I, right? Like, we believe that there's something else going on in this world that's a little bit crazy.
There's something else.
And and that to, I think, exclude that, I think excludes something that you're kind of putting blinders on for. And you do have, I mean, you're right in terms of all of the, these ancient conventions and the ways that things were spread around. And but the Gospels are written in the lifetime of the eyewitnesses. And they're written in this period of time where you have groups of individuals who could have fact-checked those things. So
how do you fact-check someone coming back from the dead?
Well, if you...
How many people saw his body, right?
Well, Paul says that 400 people saw him all at once.
400 people saw the crucifixion?
No, saw the resurrected Jesus. Yeah, 1 Corinthians 15.
That is clip number one. Your thoughts on that?
I mean, I'll just comment and say it was 500, not 400. So he does
fact
make a little bit of a numerical error in that. But, I mean, again, I do disagree with Rogan on the whole literacy thing because ancient literacy is a little bit more complicated than we give it credit for. Because, again, we might say, oh, only 20% of people were literate. No, only 20% of people were literate in Latin. I mean, as far as, like, you know, a Germanic person being literate in German or English in English. It's probably closer to 50-50 because it's not that hard to teach reading because we can teach it to kids and all you need to know is phonetic. And we do have the archaeological evidence of like notes being passed around on like bark to suggest that even like the lower classes were literate just in the common tongue, not in Latin. But so, right. I mean, he does perhaps underestimate how, I guess, or he does kind of over-assume how stupid the people were in those days.
I thought it was pretty interesting because Greek would have been the higher class language when they were talking about the creation of the Vulgate. Vulgate being a vernacular language because people spoke Latin back then in mass. Like people, in mass, I mean populations, not mass as in the
Latin
Catholic, mass. Yeah, not as in that, but they spoke Latin. That was the widespread language. So they created the Vulgate, which was a vernacular Bible, which then became the actual Bible for the Catholic Church, who then prohibited vernacular Bible translations afterwards. I thought that that was kind of funny. They didn't point out that latter irony part, but I thought it was pretty interesting that they pointed that part out. The origins of the Latin Vulgate. So, one thing that's pretty interesting about the compilation of the Gospels is that, you know, they do all happen around the same time. Which one came first, which ones used each other as sources is kind of an interesting debate. And there's like an unknown thing called Q in the middle of this. But theoretically, if Matthew was actually first, it kind of gets rid of the Q question.
Well, the key question is entirely a product of conjecture. Like, I would reject the existence of it.
Or in favor of the Matthew being first? Or
no, I would just say that the Gospels were organically produced. I reject the notion that the Gospels relied on each other for their subsequent writing. And I think there's even the fact is that the Gospel teachings are actually repeated in the epistles. From textual evidence, like, I mean, obviously, 1 John has a lot of overlap to the Gospels, especially, obviously, the Gospel of John.
No way.
Yeah, I know. I mean, Luke, I think one of Luke's passages is quoted by Paul, or like, the labor is worth his wages or something, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I believe Paul calls the Gospel of Luke his gospel or whatever. Like, doesn't he do that? So Paul and Luke work together.
I don't know if he does that specifically in reference to Luke's gospel, but I'm pretty sure he quotes teachings of Jesus verbatim. I mean, even Romans 13 is basically, shall we pay taxes to Caesar?
And then Mark is associated with Peter.
And obviously, there's parallels.
Matthew and John are both apostles in their own right. So,
I mean, there's no archaeological evidence for a gospel Q or whatever they want to call it. It's an atheist talking point.
Okay. A lot of things come up in the whole higher criticism of the late 1800s. And the funny thing about that is, like, a lot of that higher criticism came about because there wasn't there wasn't like historical evidence, so to speak, of like a lot of the Bible's claims. But since then, we've had this whole field of archaeology that's uncovered a lot of the Bible's claims to be accurate. Hasn't really uncovered a whole lot of the claims of Darwinian evolution to be accurate, but it's kind of amazing that archaeology was one of the driving forces of proving the Bible's historicity in the last 150 years.
And then when you get back to some of the more scientific claims that they discuss, I don't know if you have that, but they talk about the Big Bang theory, whereas before the Big Bang,
I can pull that up, but otherwise I don't have that locked in.
But they kind of talked about how, oh, before then they said that the universe was perpetual and didn't have a beginning. And now that they said they had a beginning, that means they have to have a beginner.
Yeah, I can pull that up real quick. That is at the 212 mark. I did take notes while I watched this of timestamps. The unhelpful thing about my timestamps is I had starting points, but I don't have ending points. But we can go to the Joe Rogan Experience and clip this, because I thought this was a pretty worthy part to listen to as well when they're talking about miracles and creation and stuff like that. I'm going to up the speed to, let's do 1.3.
In the Bible. Yeah. And I say, well, you know, if the first miracle happened, if everything, you know, nothing became everything. Right. Then, you know, Jesus turning water into wine.
That's an easy one.
Well, yeah.
That's a party trick.
Yeah, exactly.
It really is nothing compared to the birth of the universe, but we're convinced at the creation of the universe, and we're very skeptical at other miracles. It's very odd.
Yeah, it's very odd. I think there's an inconsistency there. And you do see when the Big Bang is first hypothesized that there are individuals who are uncomfortable with that sounding like in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Because before that, the idea was that the universe was eternal. Yeah. And if you propose a point in time where everything starts to exist, well, that for, and you see some of these people are pushing back on it. They say things like, well, that sounds too religious. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a beginning point in time. Right. And at that point, if there's a Big Bang, you have to figure out, okay, well, what's the Big Banger?
Right.
And I mean, that's ultimately, it's a metaphysical religious question. How did that thing get kicked off?
Brian Cox was explaining to us that there was an actual environment that existed pre the Big Bang. Don't they call it the environment? Is that what the term of it is?
Is this like Lawrence Krauss having a definition for nothing?
I don't know.
It's not nothing?
I don't know. It was just like, what are you even saying? You know, and then there's Sir Roger Penrose, who thinks there's a series of these things that happen. And then it's just this constant birth of universes and death of universes and birth of new universes. And it's like Big Bang, expansion, heat, death, contraction, Big Bang. Like, but we're almost like, that's too much. I don't want to. I can kind of wrap my head around 14 billion years. I can't wrap my head around eternity.
In theology, it's often described as the difference between understanding and comprehension, which my wife tells me are synonyms, and that's nonsense. But the idea is like, you can understand eternity as a long point in time.
Right.
You can't comprehend it.
It's like numbers. Yeah. You can understand how many zeros are in 14 billion years.
How much water's in the ocean.
Right.
I can comprehend. Like, it's like, that's a lot of water. Yeah. But when you start talking about like tens of thousands of gallons, I'm like, lost me.
Yeah. I don't really know what that.
So that was the clip talking about about miracles in general. I thought that was pretty good because, again, classical apologetics, a lot of the skepticism of the late 1800s and the liberalism that arose from there had to do with miracles and people denying miracles. And there was this notion that the earth was perpetual rather than had a beginning, or the universe was perpetual rather than had a beginning, which science no longer agrees with or has to come up with a way for that not to be the case.
Yeah, I mean,
Joe Rogan alluded to.
I mean, we probably don't need to play the clip where they're talking about the dark matter and that study. But I mean, I think the entire, argument about dark matter is that there's phenomenon in the universe that we can observe, but we can't explain using the models of the Big Bang and cosmic inflation and all that. So they suppose that dark matter exists to like essentially keep things together, because otherwise the galaxies would fall apart under their models. So they need this substance to exist in order for their models to be sustained. I mean, and again, Huff was probably a little weak on that, because I mean, obviously it's a very difficult subject matter in itself, but Christian apologists have addressed dark matter as probably being non-existent for that reason, because it's used to sustain a materialistic argument.
Oh, well, my familiarity with dark matter is that you have one dark matter and one matter, and you combine that with something, lithium crystals and stuff like that, and you can power a starship. That's my understanding of dark matter. So I thought that was a good clip, and we can probably fast forward into the Jordan Peterson clip because you wrote about that. I think that's one of the more substantive critiques, and this comes at the very end.
Yeah, that was certainly the most viral portion of the.
So I thought this was pretty interesting. If you've been following Evangelical Dark Web, oh, dark matter is not antimatter. Okay, well, my bad on that one.
Yeah,
I conflated the two.
Trying to throw your Star Trek reference.
Maybe it's possible that in the 1960s, antimatter and dark matter were synonymous. I don't know. So anyway, this part, we've been very critical of Jordan Peterson because Jordan Peterson is not someone who's a believer. He's not even, maybe you could say he's pretending to be a believer, but he is someone who finds a way to make the Bible not say what it clearly says. This is someone who...
I would say he pretends to be a seeker or pretends to be...
Yes, that is a great way to describe it. He pretends to be a seeker. I think Joe Rogan is genuinely a seeker.
Yeah, I mean, Joe Rogan's problem is he kind of took everything from the buffet and doesn't quite know how to digest it all.
He doesn't know what he like, or he doesn't know what's most valuable out of all the things he's taken from the buffet.
Yeah.
Like conspiracy theories, aliens, dark matter.
Pyramids, which they did talk about, in this interview.
Man, he should have Haunted Cosmos on. That'd be so lit. And then Christianity, which he's also fascinated in. And with, but which convincing him to value Christianity when he has so many eclectic interests, I think is kind of hard. How do you convince someone like Joe Rogan that, you know, your relationship with God is the most important thing out of all the things that he thinks is pretty important? That's the trick here with the apologetics. You got to convince Joe Rogan to believe in faith. You don't have to give him an altar call and do the 5-point gospel presentation with the colors and stuff like that. You need to convince him why the gospel matters to him. So here's the part about Jordan Peterson. And actually, I think this will include the part about Joe Rogan's perspective of Christ.
Like journeying and trying to find answers to ultimate questions. What do you think of the historical person of Jesus?
Well, it certainly seems like there's a lot of people that believe that there was this very exceptional human being that existed. Hmm. So the question is, what does that mean? Does it mean he was the Son of God? Does it mean he was just some completely unique human being that had this vision of humanity and this way of educating people and spreading this ideology that would ultimately change the way human beings interact with each other forever? So what is he the Son of God? Well, are we all? That's another question, right? Do we all have that inside of us? Do we all have that ability to change everything around us inside of us? Do we all have that unique connection to the divine? And is he a representation of the best version of that? Or was he an actual person that was the Son of God?
So I just got to say, like, Joe Rogan sounds like the narrator, not by voice, but by what he's saying. He sounds like the narrator of Ancient Aliens. Is it possible that Jesus is the Son of God, or that we all have this divine in us that we can tap and Jesus just did it the best? So he's asking all these questions. And he does at one point give the gospel answer, but this is his view of Jesus as perhaps it's sort of like a Mormon view that he's pondering here. And what's funny is they discuss how Mormonism is a cult earlier in the episode.
Like, it's funny how of all the religions in the world, he absolutely rips like LDS apart. And like Joseph Smith is a con man, and like they go to the paint on them. I don't imagine he has a lot of Mormon fans.
Well, I think Mormonism is going to collapse because it's going to give way to liberalism. Unfortunately, So hopefully we can rescue the Mormons with the gospel, but I see where the trend line is going on that.
Is it important?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, what does it mean? It's just the fact that it's a question to ponder is a miracle in itself. in a way. Just the fact that there's this concept of this person that died for our sins as the Son of God, but you have to buy a bunch, you have to believe in a bunch of stuff to go that way. Like, just the concept of that is interesting to people, because what it can do to people is offer them a very unique way to change the way they feel about the world itself. And if you do follow that, I know a lot of Christians are hardcore Christians. They're some of the nicest people you'll ever meet in your life. So it does work, right? Like, if you do live like a Christian and you do follow the principles of Christ, you will have a richer, more love-filled life. So it is true, right? But you have to submit to this concept that this guy was the child of God who came down to earth, let himself be crucified, came back from the dead, explained a bunch of stuff for people, and then said, all right, see you when I come back.
And you don't know how you can wrap your head around that particular claim.
And if he came back, here's the thing. If he came back, who the fuck would believe him today? With all the fake news and all the CGI and AI, like, imagine. That would be the most bizarre thing of all time. If we get to a point where artificial reality is indiscernible from regular reality, and Jesus chooses to come back at that moment, boy, that's the ultimate test of faith, right? When it's impossible to discern. If we really reach a point where virtual reality is indistinguishable from regular reality, which we're probably 100 years away from that or something. Like, how far? Maybe not even that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's probably.
So your thoughts on what Joe Rogan said about his conception of Christ?
I mean, obviously he's asking a lot of questions. And it seems like his biggest hang up would be, oh crap, this Christianity thing has a lot of rules to it.
Or a lot of things you have to believe in order to be a Christian.
Yeah, and he obviously, let's just be honest, he's not exactly known for, he's probably known for, you know, stoner culture, maybe a little more licentious living. He's been living the high life.
Psychedelics.
That too. So there's a lot, there's a lot he would have to change about himself in order to ascend to Christianity.
And yeah,
that's the hang up.
One other thing to point out is, and I'm not going to rag on Joe Rogan for this, but it is worth pointing out, he doesn't understand the Trinity, so he has somewhat of an Arian concept of Christ.
Well, neither does David Reese.
Most baby Christians do not understand the Trinity. That's something else to point out as well. That is something that comes along early, hopefully, in someone's sanctification journey. But I'm not going to expect someone who's not a believer to understand the Trinity. And we're going to get baby Christians to understand the Trinity. But it is not an understanding of God that comes naturally. It comes supernaturally through revelation. And we've written it down so we don't mess it up. David Reese.
Yeah, I mean, and his comments about the, you know, the VR and augmented reality and like how digitized our reality is, making truth indiscernible. I mean, we're kind of already there with the ability of AI and just even just how quick the news cycles work.
Now, I think that might be a humorous cop out.
Yeah,
like, he's trying to make a joke to offset the more seriousness of the conversation.
True. I mean,
my wife says I do that all the time.
The return of Christ is not going to be
indiscernible.
A news story in the drop of a bucket kind of thing.
So
we are probably already there where there's so much being thrown at us, and you know, who even knows what's real.
Yeah, most people didn't include this part in the context of the Jordan Peterson part, but I think that this part where Joe Rogan's kind of pondering the question is very important, actually. So it should have been included, and it leads up to the Jordan Peterson part as well.
Probably why Jesus came in the first century and not the 21st century.
But imagine if that's the big catch. Like, Jesus does return, but when he returns, we're just so confused that we can't even tell.
Yeah.
Or maybe that's how he returns in the first place. Maybe he returns through AI.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the portal to Jesus.
I don't know anything about that. Yeah.
That scares the shit out of me.
I really appreciate, guys that you're friends with, right? Like the Jordan Petersons and the Douglas Murrays of the world, or, you know, the Tom Hollands, not the Spider-Man actor, the historian, who talk about this stuff.
Okay. Douglas Murray, I assume he's talking about the homo from Britain. Does he claim to be a Christian?
No, but you know, he it's you know, the soft, he's the, you know, the Richard Dawkins soft, the branch you're sitting on.
Oh, okay.
Well, I mean, because he's
I don't know. I've heard of the Tom Holland guy that's not the Spider-Man actor, the worst Spider-Man actor, just to be clear. I've heard of him, but I don't know him. Probably because his name is Tom Holland.
I think I really like the way that Jordan Peterson articulates it, but I think he misses the forest for the trees.
How so?
In that he sees Jesus as an archetype.
Mm.
And I don't think actually even Jesus gives you the opportunity to see him as the archetype. Because I have this love-hate relationship with all of Peterson's stuff, because he seems to get so much right where he walks up to the line, but he doesn't want to cross over.
And is the crossover, you think, connected to a life in academia? Or
no.
What do you think it is?
I wonder, and I'd love to talk to him about this, like how do you remedy this issue that, because he seems to think it that the concept of Jesus as an example is more important than the actual flesh and blood, first century itinerant Jewish preacher who was crucified and rose from the dead physically, which is the claim of the Gospels and the rest of the New Testament, that's an example for us to look on and live by. But I actually think that Jesus condemns moralism. And ultimately what I see Peterson doing is looking at Jesus as a moral example. And if Jesus is nothing but a moral example, then you can save yourself and you don't actually need a savior. Mm. And so I think actually Jesus would have critiqued that, because Jesus was very against moralism.
And how do you define Jesus being against moralism? Like, what do you mean by that exactly?
So I want to pause right here, because you narrow in on the moralism part. Comment on this?
I do disagree with the use of the term moralism. Now, let me first say that he is 100% correct that, you know, he like views the archetype of Jesus as more significant than the actual claims of Jesus. And technically he does that with like the entirety of scripture, because he allegorizes it. He kind of uses a lot of, I mean, he's a student of Carl Jung, who's kind of like known for a lot of the archetypes, that not exclusive to Jung, but he psychoanalyzes, you know, the biblical text through like a Jungian perspective. So yes, he would do that with Christ as well. I actually don't think it's moralism. So, because I mean, that's more of a claim of Pelagianism. Because at the end of the day, Pelagianism asserts that man can essentially achieve eternal life, achieve salvation without the help of God.
Right, because it's a denial of original sin.
Yes, you did not.
Theoretically, Pelagius was trying to teach that we deliberately choose to sin every single time that we sin. Theoretically, that's what he was trying to teach. In practice, if you deny original sin, you basically teach, you know, you basically get yourself into believing in sinless perfectionism and a lot of other issues like that. And I think that's much of, you know, if we can achieve that, then yeah, there is some sense that we can earn our salvation.
But when you deny original sin, when you deny a lot of the, you know, when you, I mean, keep in mind, Peterson's whole shtick is, you know, the we who wrestle with God.
Yeah, and so really, he believes himself as someone who wrestles with God, and I don't see that as a case.
Yeah, I mean, it's technically the opposite. It was God coming down to wrestle with Jacob. It was God coming down to intercede and be a mediator, because we
dislocate his hip.
So it's more Pelagian thought, and that's happens throughout Christianity, where Pelagianism and semi-Pelagianism essentially remove the significance of Christ's sacrifice on the cross. Because again, if we can deliver our own salvation without Christ, or using Christ only as an example, not as like an atoning sacrifice, then, you know, we can achieve our own perfection, so to speak, then, you know, what did Christ actually die for? And you see that with a lot of like universalists, Unitarians, humanism kind of has that as like a central proponent. And you see a lot
I like to define humanism as a belief that humans are basically good and we can solve all of life's problems.
Yeah. And a lot of those ideas come out of the Reformation, not necessarily like the Reformed part, but, you know, when you start getting like the Arminians, Socinians, obviously, like there's even like humanist that came over in the colonial period. You have Unitarians in America, I want to say after the founding of the country. So you see a lot of these ideas, and obviously they settled in, you know, more in New England.
Yeah. John Harris has a whole documentary on that and a pseudonymously written book about that. So I want to finish up. this clip before I dive more into Wesley Huff, and I want to commend him for going after Jordan Peterson like this, but I'm going to let him finish in the famous words of Kanye.
Exactly.
Well, Jesus looks at the religiosity of his day with like particular groups like the Pharisees and the Sadducees, who are these other like these other groups of Jews during his day. So we talked about the Essenes, who actually aren't mentioned in the Bible, but there are other groups like the Pharisees, who are like lay scholars, and the Sadducees, who are professional priest scholars. And he's constantly critiquing the fact that they have this hypocritical religiosity to them, where they're doing things like tithing their mint leaves, like to make sure that they get all of. This is where we get the idea of the letter of the law versus the intention of the law. Like Jesus critiques them for that because he says, you're trying to do everything right and you're missing the point. So one of the things he says is like, if your donkey falls in a ravine on the Sabbath, do you pull it out or does that work? Like, what's the point of the Sabbath? Is it to not do any work? Like, is it to make sure that you're not working too hard because you might be breaking the Sabbath? Or like, what is the point? He says like the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. And that there's this intention. This is the whole Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, is he keeps saying, you have heard it said, but I say, and he refers to the Mosaic law. And it looks like he's critiquing the Mosaic law, but he's not actually. He's getting back to the intention of the law. So when he says, you know, you have heard it said, do not commit murder. But I say to you, anybody who harbors a hate for their brother in their heart has already committed murder. And what he's getting to is like, what's the intention? What's the meaning of the law that God gives to you? Because the law is like a mirror. It shows you how dirty you are. But his critique is, he's like, you guys are trying to clean yourself with a mirror. That's stupid. It's just going to, if anything, it's going to make you more messy. Like, get in the shower. The law is not what cleans you. The law is what reveals that you're dirty. And so in that sense, I think, you know, if Jesus is a moral example, it actually misses what I think Jesus actually said about what his purpose was, in that you can't do enough to actually live up to the standard that God holds you to. And so if you keep striving, you're actually going to wear yourself out and be exhausted.
Like atheists.
I didn't say you did, Joe.
A lot of them go crazy. They go crazy when they get older.
Yeah.
Listen, Wes, this is such an awesome conversation, and I'm sad that it went down the way it went down with you and Billy, but the good thing out of it is that a lot of people became aware of your work, and it's such exhaustive work. It's really amazing what you've done. Thank you so much for these gifts. We will find a great place for them on the wall here, and let's do it again. And I would love to do.
So that is the Joe Rogan Experience and Wesley Huff being on it. So let me get to what I was going to say about Jordan Peterson and Wesley Huff. Wesley Huff going after Jordan Peterson there showed a greater level of discernment. In the beginning of this, I mentioned that a lot of people in apologetics do not have good theology or are not very discerning. Wesley Huff showed a little bit more discernment than you would expect from this crowd. And I got to commend him for that.
Yeah, I mean, if he's the new rising star in apologetics, that's probably a positive sign overall, especially since it's kind of like it's a field of squishes. I mean, if we're just gonna be honest. And yeah, he's Canadian. Yeah, he did kind of, you know, saw in the chat. Yeah, he does kind of say that when he says that, like Genesis being a apologetic for paganism or against paganism. Yeah, that's kind of a little bit of a red flag. But overall, I mean, he did play his cards well. He was very selective in like which parts to, I guess, push back on Rogan on. And, you know, I don't think he's an expert on dark matter. So that's, he kind of just defaulted to like, the universe is amazing. That, and did the same thing, I guess, with the pyramids, because he's probably not an expert on that either. But yeah, I thought he did a great job. He did as well as like anyone could have done.
And I also want to say he's now a rising star in evangelicalism. He's better and more straight than that Ortland, absolutely the case. But with that said, because he was just on Rogan, you're going to see a lot of bad actors pounce on him. They're gonna take advantage of him. And here's one example of this is Preston Sprinkle. We had this guy nominated for Church Villain of the Year because he has done the devil's work in advancing homosexuality in the church under a new guise. And he said, he tweeted us out, wow, well, now, of course, I want to have Wesley Huff on Raw Theology Podcast or Theology in the Raw. Pretty brilliant stuff he unpacked on the Joe Rogan podcast. or experience. Not only was his handling of textual criticism masterful, but he explained such complex issues in an understandable way. Pretty brilliant. And Preston Sprinkle, major false teacher. Not a whole lot of people call him out. I'm one of the people who does pretty early on that, actually. But this guy is so bad. He has a lot of clips going out. I'm going to discuss Preston Sprinkle and his Bible commentary coming up, because Zondervan wants to publish a Bible commentary of his, and that's pretty bad.
Yeah, I mean,
he's a rising false teacher, and he has used academic credentials to get very far in evangelicalism, despite his terrible theology and gayness.
Yeah, I mean, this is the number one thing Wesley Huff has to look out for going forward, is that he's going to be approached. I mean, I know he was already on Apologia, but that was before Rogan. But obviously now that he's off of Rogan, yeah, if you go on like Preston Sprinkle's podcast, like that could be a huge red flag for him going forward as far as his trajectory, kind of like shooting himself in the foot before.
I mean, there are a lot of people that are young. I'm not saying he's younger than me or whatever, but I'm going to use Sadie Robertson from Duck Dynasty as an example. Like, she was part of this Christian family. She had a platform very early on, used it to, you know, promote Christian values and Christianity in general. And now she's basically sliding into false teacher territory. And that's kind of been her descent for the last couple of years. She's becoming a female preacher, and she's becoming like the next Priscilla Schreier or Beth Moore. And you hate to see that. And I don't want to see Wesley Huff go down, get trapped by people like Preston Sprinkle or some of the other bad actors out there. I don't know who's trying to pounce on him right now, but other than Preston Sprinkle. But that would be bad. And I don't want any of this W to be diminished, because it was pretty glorious. And for God's sake, mostly, because I don't know how many people are going to be saved as a result of this, but I like to think it's more than one.
Yeah.
Millions of people watched this. It was 2.3 million when I edited your article last night. That's how many it was. It is 2.9 million on YouTube alone, but there's also Spotify podcast, and it, you know, it's one of the biggest podcasts in the world. So obviously there's a large audience there, and, you know, Twitter, Rumble, I presume he's on also. So this guy has a lot of distribution channels, and a lot of people saw this. I think people are being led to faith in this. I think this is going to be a factor in sowing some seeds for people to come to faith in the near future. I'm very optimistic about the revival that's going on in the country right now.
I mean, I will say I liked what Stephen Wolf put out. It's just like, yeah, you know, he went on the Joe Rogan podcast, which is like, you know, evangelical elites were like bashing this sort of like evangelism for years. And now you see a lot of people trying to claim it and trying to like, oh, that's our boy over there. I mean, you know, Yuri like Burrito or whatever of the CREC was trying to claim it. It's just like, no, your entire camp was bashing White Boy Summer the entirety of last year. So like, no, you don't get to claim, you know, the Rogan podcast as like your guy. So yeah, you're seeing a lot of people claim
they're going to ride coattails. They're going to pounce on him to drag him into their bad theology. So definitely, like, obviously pray for Joe Rogan in this. Pray for Joe Rogan's audience, because you're not just speaking to Joe Rogan. I mean, you are speaking to Joe Rogan because he's right in front of you, and you're going to have a good conversation with him. And if you have a good conversation, it'll be a good episode. But you're also speaking to the audience that's listening and watching. And you got to pray for those people as well, that they would hear the word, that they would plug themselves into the Bible after hearing a 3-hour presentation on how the Bible is legitimate. And also for Wesley Huff, that he would not succumb to the people that are going to prey on him in this moment. And to test a man's character, you don't give him adversity, you give him prosperity. And that is pretty biblical. Job, for instance, is about that. And a number of people have gotten prosperity and become conceited. So those are three things to pray about moving forward. Any other closing thoughts? Because I don't have that much more to say on this.
No. I'm hoping he rises in apologetics and doesn't bend your, you know, bend to the culture, bend to, I guess, what is the science and the consensus, especially with regards to, you know, early creation, Genesis, evolution, which, again, those are kind of like the warning signs.
It's very hard to find a based Canadian.
Yeah. Or succumb to his Canadian-ness.
I had one on the podcast back when we were talking about the Crusades. He's pretty based.
But yeah, I'm rooting Protestant for him. I'm hoping like this one is, you know, this is like an actual our guy.
Yeah. Because we could use that. All the W's in the world. I'm a very optimistic person these days. But yeah. So those are some closing thoughts. If you like this kind of content, do also subscribe to the channel to the podcast. If you are new, check out my book, Winning That Winsome, linked in the description below. And also, we have a patron-like system that's also linked in the description below as well. It gives you bonus access to bonus content. I got some bonus content coming this weekend that's pretty spicy or interesting. Because one of them I couldn't publish quite yet as a news article for reasons that I explain in the thing. And another one's just kind of behind the scenes. I get a little more personal about evangelical dark web and sort of what we're doing here and why I'm doing it this way. John Chrysostom says, join Gab. Yes, you can find me on Gab. That is also linked in the description below. Get on Gab. It's great. It's a great social media website. It is one of the best websites for promoting evangelical dark web articles on. So I like Gab a lot. So that's all I got to say about that. That's all I got to say for tonight. Stay based. Christ is King. And we will catch you on the next one.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.